We're going to bring the meeting to order. Good morning, everyone. Let me first thank our lovely vice chair for looking out for all of us last week, especially my voice. I'm on the mend. I'm coming back. We are going to switch the testifiers this morning because we have one of our finest from the Minneapolis Police Department here, my former inspector for the 3rd Precinct, who left us to go help the entire city of Minneapolis instead of just doing a wonderful job that she was doing in South Minneapolis, that's going to testify and give us some information this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
If you can identify yourself for the tape, that would be helpful.
Certainly. I'm Assistant Chief Sharon Levinsky from the Minneapolis Police Department, and thank you for allowing me to speak first on this bill. On June 12th of 2000, the Minneapolis Police Department received a phone call, or received a 911 call, about a woman playing music loudly and had some behavioral problems. The police responded. The woman was Barbara Schneider. She was cornered in a bedroom. She had a knife, and the police department, Minneapolis police, shot and killed her. As it turns out, Barbara Schneider had significant mental health issues. That incident, that tragic incident, was really the impetus for us to take a look at ourselves about how we were handling mental health calls. What the police department did, we took a look nationally. The Memphis Police Department had a best practices program called the Crisis Intervention Team Program, which is what we adopted. It's a 40-hour training for officers who are volunteers. What they do is they work, go on-site with mental health professionals, learn the skills to deal with mentally ill individuals, and quite frankly, learn different ways to handle those calls. We're trained in the police department. You get a call, you respond, you handle it as quickly as possible, and you move on to the next thing, because at least in Minneapolis, I know there's always another call waiting. What this does, it teaches the officers to slow down, take the time to work and talk to that individual. In my opinion, the crisis intervention team program has been one of the best things I've seen now in actually 29 years of law enforcement. I believe that it has truly saved lives in Minneapolis of mentally ill people who, unfortunately, I think society, quite frankly, does not take good care of mentally ill people in society. And you know what? Then the police department becomes the safety net. And we are not a good safety net when it comes to mentally ill people. The Crisis Intervention Team program for us, I think, really has given us some of the skills and is a step in the right direction in terms of working with mental health professionals as well as really providing better and safer service to mentally ill individuals. I know for us we have, I think at this point, about 120 officers trained in this program, and we have them on every shift and in every part, every precinct of our police department. So I wanted to come and speak on behalf of Crisis Intervention Team Training, and I realize this bill, which I believe is House File 196, provides a structure to help promote that within the state of Minnesota and provide a means, a mechanism to not just have it individualized in a few different cities, crisis intervention team training, but actually spread that throughout the state. Right now, Minneapolis Police has taken the lead in training other officers from other police departments, but I think that obviously working with and providing safety for mentally ill individuals is a statewide issue and a statewide issue for law enforcement. So with that, I thank you for your time.
Are there any questions? I have one question for you. I'm curious to know what the department has been doing working with family members that may, or even family members or neighbors that may see a crisis approaching, and is there any work that the department may be doing to work with them?
Chair Walker, I think for us, We have a number of, actually, quite frankly, police chaplains that when we encounter something like this, we might have a referral to one of our police chaplains to actually reach out to some of those community members. For us in the police department, we don't take on very much of that, but I think, if I may say, that because we have the crisis intervention team training, we have now developed relationships within the mental health community, service community, and so with those relationships come a way of picking up the phone to say, this person is not getting service, here's a family member, can you help? So I think that's the other benefit of this program is relationships.
Thank you for that. I brought that question up because right when the team got put together with some of the high incidences around shootings that we had with a couple individuals, one in particular, but even right after that, a gentleman that I went to high school with, the family had tried everything that they could to get some intervention, even contacting the police department, and unfortunately wasn't able to do when he was killed by an officer. Mm-hmm. Another individual in Horn Towers where family had tried to reach out ahead of time, or neighbors, and so it's one of those things, and understanding that the capacity of the police department, and thankfully we do have chaplains, but it might be one of those things of how do we work along with the other systems, making sure that everyone's informed about what's going on, not just that individual that may be coming to the door because the individual's having a crisis at that time.
Mm-hmm. I know from our perspective in Minneapolis Police, we'd be very supportive of strengthening that outreach.
One last question for you. Do you know how many other jurisdictions that the Minneapolis Police Department right now is helping train?
Chair Walker, committee members, I don't know offhand. I do know we've had, I believe, at least three different trainings, week-long trainings that we have sponsored for other police department. I would put it somewhere between 10 and 20.
Thank you. If I don't see anyone else, I want to thank you for coming over here.
Thank you for your time.
Fine. And Dr. Zucker, and if I butchered your name, it's only because I'm not good with names. I do well with Neva. Yes. Okay. Okay. That's fine. If you could identify yourself.
I will do that.
Thank you.
George Romero, I'm a child and adolescent psychiatrist. I'm a professor of psychiatry at the University of Minnesota Medical School. I represent a group of mental health practitioners who treat children with mental health disorders. We include pediatricians, nurse practitioners, psychologists, marriage and family therapists, psychiatrists, and child and adolescent.
I'm sorry. We need you to sit down so we can hear you so well, and the tape can record your lovely words that you're about to enlighten us with.
I am unaccustomed to sit down when I'm speaking in this way.
But you have us sit down when we come see you. I'm sorry.
Got me.
I couldn't resist. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I'm here to support this bill, especially the increase in reimbursement for evaluation and treatment, reimbursement for collateral contacts, and the family psychoeducational provision. As you know, children's mental health system is under-resourced. This bill fills some of those gaps. One of our members, Dr. Carrie Borchardt, a child and adolescent psychiatrist who works at St. Paul Children's Hospital, not too far from here, if the committee had time, would have told you that for an initial evaluation, not only is it necessary to see the parent, the non-custodial parent, talk to the child's teacher, the child's social worker, the school psychologist, and the pediatrician to obtain the information that will make a treatment plan fit the child's unique circumstances. But all of these contacts are now not reimbursable. Adult psychiatry is paid the same as child psychiatry, but most of what an adult psychiatrist needs to know is sitting right in front of them. Here are the facts of reimbursement. Blue Cross Blue Shield pays $225 for an initial evaluation. For a child psychiatrist, that's at least an hour and a half of time sitting with the person and the parent and the child. Medical assistance, thank you, pays $87. Hospitals will not hire child mental health clinicians. Community clinics cannot hire child psychiatrists. Access to specialty care is doomed with these kinds of workload differences and reimbursement disparities. If Donna Milner, a pediatrician, were here, but cannot be here because of time constraints, she's the director of emergency room services at St. Paul Children's Hospital. She would tell you that half of the children seen in that emergency room with mental health problems require inpatient care. Of these children, about half are in the emergency room for more than 6 hours waiting for a bed. 7% never find a bed in the Twin Cities. These are real children with families who travel to Duluth and beyond to be with their sick child. What other health condition would require this kind of travel and family displacement? However, Donna would support the community crisis services that are in this bill because all child mental health clinicians would agree that community services and early intervention are good public health policy. If Kim McFadder were here, a nurse practitioner, she would support the family psychoeducation provision of the bill because she knows that for every case, a parent has the same question. What part of my child's behavior is due to mental illness, and what part requires expert parenting? A nurse practitioner is a highly trained mental health professional and can answer this question. Because there's no reimbursement mechanism for this service, this gap is filled with free care. In addition, because of some misunderstandings of the competencies of a nurse practitioner, some services that she is trained for, certified to deliver, are not being reimbursed. On the public side, this is being addressed by DHS. There's a question about the private side. It creates access problems in an under-resourced system with a terrible workforce shortage when trained mental health providers are unable to obtain reimbursement for things that they are capable, certified, trained to deliver. Finally, I'm here to support this bill as it has a provision that I have advocated for as a member of the State Mental Health Advisory Council since 1987. We will continue to have shortages of services and clinicians to serve children with mental health problems as long as this resource shortage exists. Medical students will not go into a field where the standard of care is not supported with reimbursement. They either give away the service, if allowed by their health system, or provide inadequate care and try to feel good about that. Please adequately resource the children's mental health system of care. Thank you.
Where are you going? Wait.
I'm too agitated.
I was going to use the word passionate, but you are the doctor. Are there any questions by members, Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, you mentioned individuals that are having to go someplace else throughout the state. Do you have statistics as how many people who, say, live in one area and now have to be situated in a different city or town or part?
Not every. Thank you for the question. Not every hospital tracks those kinds of things. At St. Paul Children's, the predicament is sending someone home who needs hospitalization or admitting them to Children's Hospital. Neither Children's Hospital is certified for the care of psychiatrically disturbed children. So you have nurses who have no understanding of how to manage those cases. So nurses get kicked, pushed, bitten, because there's nowhere else to send them. Within the past year, of the hospitals that keep track of that, 35 kids couldn't be hospitalized in Fairview or Abbott Northwestern and had to go to Duluth or McKinnon Hospital in South Dakota. We don't know how many St. Cloud turns away. We don't know how many other hospitals that don't have children's units or psychiatric units turn away. We're not tracking that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At least you didn't mention Canada, which I have heard in the past as a place to send children. Dr. Rimalto, you are also speaking for Dr. Milner. I think it was her when you were in my office. She was describing children who come to the emergency room with their families and they need to stay because they're so out of control and the parents are afraid of them or afraid to take them home for them. But yet they hadn't ever been identified or even ever in the mental health system. Could you talk about that? Because I think that would be important for the committee to hear.
Thank you for that question. That gets to the need for early identification. New cases that come to an emergency room where there are crises, suicidality, danger to others, that doesn't need to happen. There are screening devices. Ask any first grade teacher who's going to be a problem. These are people who know children, know development, and can identify kids who are at risk. We can identify at-risk kids. We can provide services early on. There's a parent here who will talk about this, who will say that had my child been identified early, the years of mental health treatment and hospitalization would probably have been avoided or diminished because we would have given services before the problem became chronic, before the person began to internalize themselves as a mentally ill person. People shouldn't have to identify themselves as being, well, who am I? I'm mentally ill. No, you're a person. And that's the difference between early identification and building skills, and people who go through life understanding that their circumstances is who they are. That's a tragedy.
Representative Anderson?
Thank you. Doctor, you mentioned a teacher being able to identify that child in school at an early age. Why isn't it being done then? If you say it can be done, why aren't the schools... Why isn't there something coming out of schools saying, we have a problem? Or is it?
Doctor.
These are real powerful questions. Schools who identify mental health problems that are interfering with education are worried that the Department of Education, the school system, will be responsible for their care. Now, EBD services are meant to deal with kids who have emotional problems and are in school. But you know, I represent the mental health system. It's my job to treat mentally ill kids. The integration between school and the mental health system is not there. Some counties have used their local collaborative timeshare dollars to create that. And we all know what's going on with that money. If that money is not replaced, it's another provision of this bill, we will have, again, a disconnect between education and mental health. There's been a bill for several years where support services for schools to do that identification and to make that connection between education and mental health possible. It's another gap. It's another under-resourced area. It's a non-reimbursable service. You can't run a system when you have all of these gaps, and those gaps are a consequence of no resources, no reimbursement, no allowable billing.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, if there is a noticeable child in the classroom and a teacher knows about it, and yet a parent doesn't come forward with, saying that their child is in need of help. Does the child just fall through the cracks?
You know, a parent's relationship with the school system is sometimes good and sometimes not so good, depending on their own experience. parents who have had good experiences in the school system see the school as an institution that's supportive of their child. They go in, they understand that help is available for their child, and things go well. That's not always the case, and then there's these conflicts. You know, most issues are how do you get along with other people? And you can't legislate that. But you can provide resources so that there's an opportunity for those conversations to take place.
Thank you, Manager.
That's pretty good for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to respond to Representative Anderson's concerns and confirm some of what Dr. Realmuto, am I pronouncing your name?
Realmuto, thank
okay.
you.
Referred to, I served on the Mankato Area Public Schools School Board the last 11 years, and I would say what typically happens, and I spent a lot of time in the schools and a lot of time with our special ed staff, and typically those children end up in the special education program. They're identified as EBD and they do get services, but they don't always get the mental health services they need outside of the school system. The school, if you look, if you brought a few special ed directors in here to testify, you'd get some much more full-fledged information in this area. But I want to reaffirm the point you made about partnerships with counties. The Mankato area has had an incredible partnership with Blue Earth County that has developed the South Central Service, South Central Children's Project, but that project is just about falling apart because of the timeshare dollars. And that was a partnership where we had co-location workers from the county in our schools that helped create that liaison between the school and the family so that services were given, especially with high mobility families and high risk families. So there are models out there as to how to do this, but they need resources.
I'm going to take one last question. And EBD, emotional behavior disorder.
Oh,
that's all right. Representative Madore.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, I am like you. I want to stand up right now. And I work with families with special needs in my school district 196, and in particular I work with families who have children who might be diagnosed with autism. As a regular pattern here, what I normally have to do is advise parents that it will be at least 9 months before their child is evaluated. In that time, they're languishing in the schools, oftentimes with a half-time school psychologist to serve sometimes 200 to 300 students, and then that school psychologist usually is shared amongst 2 or 3 schools, so she may only be rotating into my school 1.5 days a week. We also have a lot of problems with teachers being able to not have the ability to handle these children because they're untrained. We can't bring nurses in. The school nurses are not prepared to deal with this. So oftentimes the children are put into a special education or into an EBD program, never really being identified what their issues are. And I can tell you that story. Dozens and hundreds of kids in my districts have gone through that. So, like you, I just want to stand up and say, this is it. This is why we don't have these services, and I'm just really glad that you're here today to talk about this. So, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. I thank you for coming to testify. I told you that you were going to stimulate discussion. So, we ran into each other in the hallway. Come on up. And before we have our next testifier, we do have a quorum, so the meeting is officially started. And if we can get Representative Wardlaw, have you looked at the minutes?
Yes, I have, Madam Chair, and I move that we approve them.
Thank you. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved. Thank you. And if you could identify yourself for the tape, we'd appreciate that.
Madam Chair Walker, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Jonathan Euker. I'm a practicing adult psychiatrist at several clinics in the North Metro area, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Psychiatric Society, our membership, and I am very grateful to Mindy Greiling for all of her work on House File 196, and we are very much in favor of what is in this. You know, I see what we do as psychiatrists is very little in terms of what actually is needed for mental health care. My role, which is primarily prescribing medications, is really you know, a small drop in the bucket in terms of what is needed to provide care for many individuals with, especially those individuals with serious mental health issues. And we believe that this bill addresses many of the service needs that are not covered or provided at this time in an adequate fashion. One of the things that I do want to talk about today that's not mentioned in here, though, however, is related to the issue or the crisis with access to inpatient hospitalization. This has been in the news. It's it really is a crisis at this time. And I personally see this as basically an issue of reimbursement for hospitals. And again, this is not anything to do with reimbursement for psychiatrists, but to pay the actual cost of a hospital bed, things such as nursing staff, laboratory services, food services. And basically, at this point, hospitals lose money on psychiatric beds. It's been estimated about $1,000 a day on a psychiatric bed, and there is no incentive to keep them open. And if anything, I think we're going to see further closures. And as new hospitals are built, they're not going to want to have psychiatric units as a component of their services. And if anything, that's going to worsen this crisis. And it affects all kinds of people. Those of us that work in the business have heard these stories over and over and over. My recent one this last weekend was a woman who first episode of depression. She's suicidal. She's an international accountant for a major organization or company here in the Twin Cities. And it took them almost 2 days of sitting in the emergency room to get a bed. During that time, she just sat there with her husband and family. And to me, this is not only a crisis, but it's reaching the proportions of being immoral. So I hope that something could be done to address that issue as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Ubert. Are there any questions? Members have Representative Reinhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is more by way of comment to support the crisis that you're mentioning, Doctor, in hospitals. Hospital beds being available. Mankato is currently, as we speak, in a crisis over this exact issue. Our hospital is moving toward the decision to close its inpatient psychiatric ward. And we're trying, Senator Sharon, who is the senator in our district and has background in psychiatric nursing, is trying to move a community discussion as to what our alternatives are, and bring both the medical community and the mental health community and the broader community together to look at the situation before the closing occurs so that we don't get in a position where we can't retrieve the service. So I'm just confirming that it is a very serious issue, and we're in the middle of that problem.
Representative Grimley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Uecker, when, as you probably know, when this bill was developed, I asked the Mental Health Legislative Network to come up with a bill that would fill the gaps in the mental health system. So I'm not sure why this is not in the bill. And I know you're part of that network. I don't know if you asked for it and the group did not agree, or if it just was an oversight that it wasn't discussed. But I want to assure you that this was supposed to, there's many bills around here, and some of them are try to focus on this or that, but this was meant to be an umbrella bill that did include everything anyone could think of in the mental health network that was lacking in capacity and in topic in the mental health system. So I would urge you to talk to the network as well, and I'd be happy to add that into the bill, because this was not to be the frugal bill.
Representative Greiling, there is an amendment that you will be seeing.
Oh, Representative, or Chair Walker, thank you.
They are working on some language from after the meeting that we had, and so hopefully, Dr. Uecker.
Well, if I may comment, I think many of these services will help take the pressure off of inpatient utilization. My personal feeling is that also the inpatient setting is probably the setting of last resort. We want people to be treated in their home communities, at home, in the most open environment possible. But there's still a need at times for people to have acute level care.
Representative Rood.
Thank you, Chair Walker, and thank you for your testimony. Very compelling today. Forgive me, this may be a really basic question, but in talking about the problem with reimbursement for mental health services in general, does it stem back to how do we fix that? Is it the RVUs? I know we had testimony in one of our health committees, and they were talking about the people in the committee who set the value for the RVUs. That's how people are reimbursed in healthcare when you fill out your forms for charging. The people who set the rates tend to do procedures. They're not people necessarily who are providing mental health services. I don't know if this is making sense, but
Stephanie,
can you insight on that?
Can you tackle that?
I am sorry. I know very little bit about the financial business. And, you know, I think there would be other people who could better. I mean, I guess we could get you that information. I know our MPS president, Roger Kathol, is very knowledgeable about funding streams and how funding works and how services are reimbursed, but I personally am a little bit in the dark and confused about that. But, yes, it does have something to do with that, but I think there's other factors at play.
Representative Rood, we could either see someone in the audience or we could have some information back to us. It's up to you.
Well, if there's somebody here who can answer that,
I'm looking over to that corner.
That. I'm just trying to get to the
someone
cause of that. Where is that problem? And where is that?
I was looking, and he wasn't looking back at me, so I figured he didn't really want to come up.
Dominic, he may be able to kind of help out with this question.
I'm Chairman Dominic Rosetto. I work with the Minnesota Psychiatric Society. Representative Rood, that's a very complex issue, and I would prefer to have some time to get people together and get you the information. If I could, one of the reasons that we don't have a portion of this issue in the bill is because we don't really know what the solution is. And I think so what we're trying to deal with is to gather some people together that might come up with recommendations on how to proceed. Because a lot of it is based on this reimbursement system in hospitals. A lot of it is private health plan information. A lot of it is stuff that we as a legislature may not even have purview over. So it's a very complex issue, but we're looking forward to going forth with something, at least in the bill.
Thank you for that. Thank you, Dr. Uecker. I believe Mary Reagan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mary Regan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies, and I'm here today in substitution for John Kruger, who is on the agenda. You do have a packet in your materials that's stapled with this map on the front, and his testimony is at the end of that packet. I'm here with two colleagues to ask for your support for House File 196 and in particular the rate increase for providers of children's therapeutic services and supports under medical assistance, also known as CTSS. MCCCA is a statewide association of providers of treatment services for children and adolescents founded in 1975. Our members provide services across the continuum of care. We also have members who provide treatment interventions to youth and correction system. I'm also representing the CTSS Coalition, which is a network of agencies which have been certified by the state and counties as providers of CTSS services. CTSS, including day treatment, is a compilation of services that were historically funded through contracts with counties and schools. Providers develop these services in partnerships with counties and schools to respond to the needs of their students and clients. As the shift to funding these services through medical assistance has occurred, the financial support from the budget-challenged counties and schools has essentially disappeared. As you know, medical assistance is designed to cover only medically necessary services. Unfortunately, the needs and problems of the children and families being served have not shifted, remain complex, and in many cases require considerable collaboration and coordination with others. Medical assistance is not able to fund many of the services the counties and schools look for from these providers. and the providers are frequently put into the position of having to set limits with their referrers as well as themselves on what they can provide. The handout in your packet will tell you more about these providers and the history of the rate setting and rate adjustments for these services. The primary message we hope to present today is that the current rates for these services are inadequate, that providers who work with children incur additional costs in consultation, collaboration, and connection with the many other systems and people involved, and without some additional resources, many of these providers have or will be forced to discontinue these kinds of services. An increase of 33.7% is necessary to even approach covering the costs of providing this treatment to these vulnerable children and families, and will help maintain the infrastructure of the mental health delivery system. We're grateful to Representative Greiling for her work on this bill. There are many wonderful things in this bill. We're also grateful to Representative Otremba for taking on the rate increase individually. And unless there are questions...
Who can have the other testifiers? You can identify yourself for the tape, please.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair and Honorable Representatives, for the opportunity to be with you today. I am Cheryl Smetman-McHugh. I am a social worker, and I'm Director of Programs at Therapeutic Services Agency, which provides in-home family-based services in 9 counties in East Central Minnesota and the Metro Counties. We provide services to children, youth, and families in need. We receive many referrals for children under the age of 8. Their presenting issues include anxiety problems, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, attention deficit disorder, often with hyperactivity also, adjustment disorders, and attachment disorders, etc. Especially worth noting is that most of these children have families who are also experiencing significant challenges. Their parents have mental health problems or chemical health problems or both. Their families often live in poverty. The home frequently sees domestic violence. Their poor parenting skills. The family lacks social supports and connection. Often these families are working with child protection services in their counties. Many of these children have been abused and neglected, or both. We also receive referrals for older children and teens. These children and youth, too, have the plethora of mental health diagnoses I have already mentioned and impairments of functioning in their family lives, school experience, community behavior, employment readiness, and friendship experiences, or lack of them. Many of the children and youth we provide services to are living at home with their families. Others are children and youth who are living with foster families or are in relative placement, pre-adoptive placement, or with their adoptive families. In providing services to children and youth utilizing CTSS, we are required to provide services to the child that is specific to their need, diagnosis, impairment of functioning, based on medical necessity, and utilizing evidence-based best practices. We also are required to coordinate those treatment efforts with other providers and persons involved in matters concerning the child's mental health. I will provide a typical case example. We received a referral to provide services to a 12-year-old girl and her brother. Their history includes abandonment by their mother, who left them alone when she left with a man to go to another state. After 3 weeks of being home alone at ages 9 and 11, they came to the attention of the local county child protection department. They were placed in foster care and lived there until this girl's behaviors became more than that foster family could tolerate. They were then placed in another foster home. The girl presents with significant depression, frequent stealing problems from family members in the home and in stores, conflict with her foster family and brother, is failing in school, and is obese. She pines for her mother, who is not available to her. The county is involved in the termination of parental rights proceedings in court and will ultimately seek to have this girl and her brother adopted. She also engages in self-injurious behaviors, which require periodic medical attention and is very distressing to her foster parents. Now, it's at this point that we begin CTSS treatment services. And I'll encourage you to note the yellow page that's in your packet that indicates some of the players that we work with in coordination of services. It's very important, as you can guess, that coordination of services occurs beyond that just being a requirement of the service. We coordinate with the multiple service providers. the family skills trainer who works with this girl and her brother, and also with her and her foster family, the individual psychotherapist, the psychiatrist who is prescribing medication to begin treating the depression, the school who is assessing her and determining how to help with school success, the medical professionals who treat her injuries as they occur and assist with health and diet issues. We work with the diversion or probation officer who got involved when she last stole from the local store. We also work with the county child protection social worker and this child's guardian ad litem who are involved with the court proceedings and recognize that those matters impact this girl's mental health. We work with the foster parents who care deeply about this girl and live with the daily challenges they face as she pushes them away emotionally and then begs for attention and needs so much. Now, I'd love to tell you all the details of this girl's story, and I will tell you this. After 15 months of treatment, this girl is now much less depressed. She has experienced being an A student and has developed significant skills in being a poet and a public speaker. She has known success and meaningful connection with her foster parents, has been active in her church youth group, and went on a mission trip to help with orphaned children. She was elected to her student council. She has not had an incident of stealing in a long time. She has lost weight and looks healthy. She and her brother get along better and enjoy a healthier relationship. She has friends in the community, and she is fun to be with. She has grown in her management of her grief at the loss of her mother. She is currently living with her adoptive family. This is very important work that we do with Minnesota's children. And they are needy and they are deserving great professional services, such as CTSS. As service providers, we are needing your support to provide this important work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Jane Sharkey. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist, and I'm a director of a home-based agency. And with the case that Cheryl just gave you, I am going to give you a typical work week of what our mental health practitioners have to go through in order to provide services. In order for a mental health practitioner to be in compliance with the CTSS guidelines, thorough coordination of services must be provided in order to ensure the functioning related to a child's emotional disturbance diagnosis. Please see the green sheet in your packet with the chart to review a typical week for a mental health practitioner providing skills services to a child with a history of sexual abuse and self-mutilation, such as the case that Cheryl just talked to you about. In a typical work week, 7.5 hours, non-billable, can be spent on coordination of services for the client. These services can include phone calls and or meetings, and for example, I've listed all the different types of services that my mental health practitioner is expected to do. That be phone calls to the parents, to the school, to the social worker, to the probation officer, in hope of setting up a team meeting, for example, for everybody to get together and be on the same page with regards to services for this child. Using this example, the agency can only bill 2.5 hours for the travel time and skills training services provided to the client and family as follows. 1 hour of travel paid at $27 an hour, 1.5 hours for a direct contact at $94.08 per hour, and the total amount the agency can bill for those services is $128.08. In this example of a typical case in a typical week, the total of $121.08 paid for the services results in an actual rate of $12.10 per hour for those 10 hours of services provided. That $12.10 per hour has to cover all the costs to the agency of providing the services, including employing qualified staff, supervision, malpractice insurance, and all of the usual overhead costs. Mileage costs, a significant issue for those agencies and practitioners serving clients in outstate Minnesota, are also not covered. The dedicated mental health practitioners who, in the end, are expected to deliver quality services despite the reality of their many unreimbursed expenses, quickly move on once they achieve licensure as a mental health professional. Office-based services become much more attractive than the costs and risks associated with home-based services. This high turnover rate creates an access issue for clients needing home-based CTSS services and increases costs for agencies and additional training and supervision costs. An increase of 33.7% in the CTSS rates will help agencies who are dedicated to this important mental health service by providing reimbursement that more closely approaches the cost of the services. Thank you for this opportunity and your support for the mental health services.
Any questions, Representative Anderson?
Yeah.
You're probably going to ask my question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kind of look at all the different testifiers here. Ms. McHugh, you mentioned something under the CTSS Coordination of Services, a psychotherapist, and I'm just wondering where that person fits into. I don't see that name, and maybe it's under a heading that isn't on that yellow sheet, but I'm asking the question where that psychotherapist would fit.
A psychotherapist would be a CTSS provider.
Okay, service provider. Thank you.
Any other questions? I want to thank you for the work that you're doing, and thank you for coming to testify this morning. Mr. Grubb?
Yep.
Good morning, sir. If you could identify yourself for the tape.
Representative Walker and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to be here today to talk about the mental health needs of our communities. My name is Jim Gruba, so you got to put an A on that name on your list. And I'm a licensed psychologist and also the executive director of the Yuba Development Center, which is headquartered in Duluth and serves approximately 8,000 clients a year in Lake, Cook, Southern St. Louis, and Carlton counties in northeastern Minnesota and Douglas County in Wisconsin. We provide a comprehensive array of mental health services, including adult and child psychiatry, outpatient therapy, adult and child case management, rehab services, crisis response teams, services to the homeless, and other community services. Today I speak on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs, a statewide group of providers similar to the Human Development Center that provides services at 120 locations throughout the state. Steve Lipinski from one of our organizations was going to be here as well today, but he's unable to attend, so I will attempt to speak for him as well. Consumers and families have spoken to you in the past few weeks about concerns that relate to funding, reimbursement, and access to needed services. Many of these consumers and families rely on medical assistance for health coverage and turn to community mental health centers to meet their needs. Compared to other providers, we have a very high percentage of medical assistance clients. We welcome them and serve them well and lose money despite our productivity and efficiency. We can address this issue by rate increases for our services and by adding coverage for services that are needed and provided but not currently paid for by medical assistance. And you've certainly heard some stories about that. And just to make a comment, in community mental health, the golden years, I think, were somewhere before my time, so it was a while ago. But there's this notion that we're there to provide the service and not care so much about money. Well, that notion is long gone, but staff still struggle with the issue. If we are to provide people regardless of ability to pay, how do we do that and still be a business? And so CTSS, when we meet to talk about how to make this work, question comes up, why do we even provide it if we lose money, if we're struggling to stay afloat? And the answer that I give is, this is at the core of our mission, this is important to our clients, and they know that. And we have to keep doing it in hopes that eventually it will be paid for adequately and we'll be able to be compensated for what we do. With coverage of family psychoeducation in Sections 2 and 13 of House File 196, we can provide parents and spouses the education they need to understand, care for, and support their loved ones. At the end of the day, it's family that we turn to for help when we're in trouble, and supporting and educating the families of persons with serious mental illness is smart from both a human and a dollars and cents perspective. To provide good treatment, we need first to do good assessments, and other folks have talked about that as well. Section 3 for adults and 13 for kids provides for improved rates for diagnostic assessments so that proper treatment can be prescribed for adults and children with serious mental health problems. Many of the services in CPSS and ARMS, which is the adult rehab services, are provided by mental health practitioners who are trained but need supervision and need a good starting point, and that adequate diagnostic assessment is very essential, and we need to be paid in order to do that. The high demand for mental health services means we need more mental health professionals. Section 5 of the bill provides reimbursement for mental health centers to provide the supervision and training provided by newly licensed social workers. Section 6 increases the reimbursement rate for travel. Best practice calls for us to provide certain services to clients in their homes rather than having them come into clinics. The current reimbursement rate is half the actual cost of travel. This is especially critical in our rural areas where distances are much greater, and earlier I referred to the 120 sites throughout the state. So we have many rural members of our association. Our association has utilized the federal rural health grant to install televideo equipment in about 45 sites throughout the state. This allows specialists to provide treatment to clients in areas that do not otherwise have the service. For instance, a psychologist specializing in a particular mental health problem could be located in Duluth and by televideo provide therapy to a client in Thief River Falls or Wadena or some other location that doesn't have that same specialty. Medical assistants and other funders will pay for the service at the same rate they'll pay for a face-to-face delivery of that service, but there's not payment for equipment or the cost of linking those sites. The funding in Section 7 of the bill will help us cover some of those costs and deliver services to where they are needed. Coverage of intensive outpatient treatment in Section 9 will allow us to package the right combination of therapy, psychiatry, and rehabilitation services in order to treat difficult conditions such as eating disorders and borderline personality disorder. This is a level of service that's typically available only in a costly hospital or residential. Section 27 increases rates for critical access services that didn't receive increases in legislation last year, and I believe there we're talking about CPSS and day treatment. A real critical area that I want to mention is dual eligible clients. Individuals who are disabled often are what we call dual eligible clients, meaning they end up on a combination of medical assistance and Medicare. Current state regulations mean we get paid less for these dual-eligible, disabled, higher-need clients than we get paid for clients on medical assistance only. So there's sort of a disincentive to serve the people that are really at the core of our mission that we need to serve. We lose thousands of dollars providing other services as well, but in particular psychiatric services to dual-eligible clients. With federal approval, Section 12 will help us lose less money on psychiatry. I want to add just an example of how the lack of payment affects situations. There's a shortage of psychiatrists. We are very fortunate at the Human Development Center to have 5 psychiatrists, including 3 child psychiatrists. I hate to say that out loud because people might try to recruit them because we can't pay them all that well. But and we have a waiting list for people to see those psychiatrists. But because we lose so much money delivering services to the underinsured and uninsured, I just did a deal with a state-operated facility in St. Peter, Minnesota to sell 12 hours of psychiatry via televideo because it will make us a few bucks and help offset those losses. I didn't like doing that, but that's sort of the reality we struggle with right now. House File 196 would eliminate co-payments for mental health services. I'd ask you to think about the co-payment issue, and I'm sure this has been brought to your attention. Do we really want to discourage people with mental illness from keeping their appointments and taking their meds by requiring a co-payment they struggle to afford? Several sections of the bill create a common mental health benefit so that consumers get the same benefits regardless of which of the state's public health insurance programs they're on. Health insurance coverage changes due to a variety of circumstances. It makes for good health care and makes smart business sense if we make it easier for consumers to follow their treatment plans and life goals without having to look over their shoulder to see who's paying that month. Each of these proposals that I talked about, as well as others that I didn't have time to mention, are a piece of the puzzle. We have made great strides in Minnesota towards what we know works best for persons with mental illness. We are grateful to the legislature for past leadership and support. We are doing good work, and we can do better. We urge you to find the resources to better serve your constituents with mental illness, their families, and their communities. Thank you for your time, and I would be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there any questions or comments from members? Seeing none, I just want to thank you again.
Thank you.
If we can have Ms. Myron and Ms. Brooks come at the same time.
Ms. Brooks won't be here. This won't be here.
Okay.
You can identify yourself, ma'am.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Maureen Myron. I'm the Executive Director of the Mental Health Consumer Survivor Network. I first want to bring your attention to House File 196, Article 4, Section 8, peer-to-peer support services language has been revised and introduced as House File 416, authored by Representative Reinhart. The Mental Health Consumer Survivor Network supports peer-to-peer support for many reasons. As the only consumer organization in this state, we have personal experience with the powerful benefits that come with interacting with people that have similar struggles and are achieving their personal recovery goals. The President's new Freedom Commission on Mental Health final report in 2003 states that recovery-oriented services and supports are often successfully provided by consumers through consumer-run organizations and by consumers who work as providers in a variety of settings, such as peer support and psychosocial rehabilitation. The new Freedom Commission goes on to state that studies show that consumer-run services and consumer providers can broaden access to peer support, engage more individuals in traditional mental health services, and serve as a resource in the recovery of people with psychiatric diagnosis. To those of us living with psychiatric diagnosis, this is much more than a report. This is truth. Peer support and the benefits of peer support are not unique to people with mental illness, much the opposite. Peer support is a natural human response to being labeled, isolated, oppressed, and discriminated against. Rooted in compassion, the instinct or to help or be helped by peers is perennial in the history of humanity. However, the legacy of peer support for people with psychiatric diagnosis, although there is organized evidence found as far back as 1830, is largely anecdotal with a scarcity of recorded published data. This, I believe, is a direct result of the debilitating stigma that has so infiltrated our society and our very beings. With many of those erroneous beliefs centered around the inability of people with mental illness to contribute to our own well-being, let alone that of others. Mental illness ranks first among illnesses that cause disability in the United States. However, far too many Americans fail to receive services, or have access to recovery-oriented services. Since the 1970s, consumer-operated services, including peer support, have matured, diversified, and increased across the United States. Part of that maturation process has been studies measuring outcomes of peer support services. Much knowledge and early evidence of the importance of peer support comes out of accounts written by persons with mental illness. In these writings, the processes and outcomes in consumer-operated services, including peer support, are documented, laying the groundwork for future quantitative studies. Sally Zinman, the executive director of the California Network of Mental Health Clients, wrote, "Peer support demystifies our emotional life, giving back to us the knowledge and the tools to help ourselves. Our emotional life is no longer somebody else's. We are no longer the medical profession's specialty. We are the experts." In the oral histories conducted as part of the Well-Being Project in 1989, Many consumer leaders discuss the value of peer support programs in reducing psychiatric problems, building empowerment, personhood, and social connectedness. In 2000, Georgia became the first state in the country to provide peer support services as a Medicaid reimbursable service, closely followed by Arizona. Since then, at least six other states are providing medical reimbursable peer specialist services, including Washington, Michigan, Virginia, South Carolina, and Pennsylvania. Minnesota has the opportunity to, using language from the most well-known peer-to-peer organization, that of AA, take what we need and leave the rest. All of those states have incorporated a certified peer specialist curriculum to provide a wider array of recovery services to people with mental health diagnosis. Milestones to Recovery, a consumer survivor network peer support program since 2005, has had enormous success in our collaboration with the county, Ramsey County Mental Health Center. Working under the center's ARMS certification, are people familiar with ARMS, or am I using an acronym unfamiliar?
I am, however you probably would like to.
Adult Rehabilitative Mental Health Services. We work with the center's ARMS certification. Our recovery specialists work out of the mental health center, providing RAP classes, Wellness Recovery Action Plan classes, on a daily basis. These classes are peer facilitated and provide the opportunity to individuals to identify their recovery, to view themselves from a lens of wellness as opposed to illness, and make plans to achieve their goals that help them maintain that wellness. CSM provides also for general wellness RAP, Wellness Recovery Action Plan, and also vocational RAP. In addition to those RAP classes, Milestones Recovery Specialists offer peer support in the community for those who are unable to come to the center, and also peer support at the center. Since March of 2005, when we first started seeing clients or participants of Milestones, we have served over 100 participants, with over 90% of them reporting that they have met at least one of their recovery goals by participating with Milestones. The importance of peer services is not unique to those of us with psychiatric diagnosis. All similarities, common obstacles, or achievements are spread through modeling, mentoring, sharing similar experiences. This is what people do. What is unfortunately unique for those of us with mental illness is that our humanity is stripped away by illness, our personalities are defined by symptoms, and our lives are limited by diagnosis. But it does not have to be that way. And it is time for Minnesota to take the lead in ensuring that those ingrained, damaging beliefs are challenged and changed. Just as a person grieving the loss of a loved one is comforted and let hope by someone who has lost, as the same way a cancer survivor shares the journey with someone newly diagnosed, and a veteran, I use veteran instead of older, I don't know why, a veteran parent share their experience with the unsure new parent, it is time that people with mental illness are afforded the same human opportunity to heal, stumble, recovery, make mistakes, change our minds, because that is what we all do, no matter what the obstacle or issue that confronts us. Peer support is offering what any and all of us need at various times for various reasons. It is time that those of us with psychiatric diagnosis have the same opportunity to live and share a life defined by wellness as opposed to illness. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Martin. Are there any questions? You guys got quiet. Why not? There we go.
Thank you, Chair Walker. I just want to thank you for such an eloquent presentation on the value of peer support. I think in many areas of our culture and health system, we lose sight of the importance of having someone stand by us who knows what we're going through, and particularly in mental health because of the stigma of mental illness diagnosis. I think the value of having a friend, and I would just say Representative Tinkelstedt has taken the freshman legislators through a peer-to-peer support process where we're not isolated in our newness to, a scary experience and I'm not trying to, underestimate it, but to make clear just that it's about having someone there who really just understands what you're going through, and there's no substitute for that in any area of our life.
Thank you.
Thank you for that. Thank you for testifying.
Madam Chair, Representative Brian Hart, if I may just comment on that.
Ms. Maher.
I think there's some really interesting studies around particularly developing countries, agrarian societies, in which they don't have as much stigma and issues with mental health diagnosis, and it looks to be a big part of that. It's certainly not about a difference in commonality or how often mental health issues occur, but there certainly seems to be a lot of difference in how many of those societies incorporate people with mental health diagnosis in their society. They still have a place, they still belong, they still have peers. And I think that that's something that we often overlook in the society. Thank you.
Representative Growley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I agree with that 100%. And I would add, I've had a chance to go to a workshop on that very topic, how other countries handle people with mental illness. And in China, I thought also it was interesting, everyone has a job, even if it's, you know, a small job, but it's something that they do every single day. So they have that community, that support, and something productive to do every single day.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you, Representative. Thank you. Ms. McNellis? For members that were late, Ms. Levinsky was our first testifier part of this discussion, and so hopefully you can get clued in with this testifier here. If you can give your name for the tape, please.
My name is Susan McNellis. I'm a member of the board of directors of the Barbara Schneider Foundation. I'm also an assistant county attorney. I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to discuss this section of the bill that we is regarding the review of mental health fatalities that have been occurring in the community. I've been active in the mental health community for many years in my professional life as a Metro County prosecutor. I've seen the enormous overlap between our criminal justice system and a population that struggles with mental illness without the support and assistance they need to live successfully in our communities. That's why I think it is accurate to say that in reality what we have done is criminalized mental illness. We have to find a way to respond appropriately and effectively to those with a mental illness who come in contact with our criminal justice system. Criminal justice professionals and staff are not mental health providers, and they often are unaware of the mental illness of those in the courts, corrections, or who are responded to by law enforcement. This leads to many bad outcomes, as you are aware. Some are overwhelming tragedies, like the one that was portrayed and discussed here on 60 Minutes last Sunday. Jail staff in Minnesota have told us that they are aware of that case and that it is not an impossibility that kind of death could occur in our system. Typically, when there is a death in the community where mental illness is a factor for either the victim or the perpetrator, there is a criminal investigation, but there is no institutional review as occurs when in an in-hospital death, for example. We can all think of possible scenarios that would lead to a high profile in the media where mental illness is a major factor for the victim or the perpetrator, such as a woman with a knife who thinks the police are there to kill her, so she fights back and she is killed. The man who tries unsuccessfully to get into a hospital to access care for mental illness and then either kills someone or ends up in a confrontation on the street and dies, or both. Or a mom who throws her children off the bridge, to list only a few of the possible scenarios that are familiar to this audience. Often in cases like this, the person has had contact with many professionals in the mental health and criminal justice systems. But because in the past we have not understood that mental illness is a brain disorder, or because of the different legal framework that each profession operates under, or because it is one more task that we're asking an already overburdened system to do, we have not done a review of these deaths. An independent review of a select number of cases where leaders in our system think we could learn from our practice, improve the policies and procedures used in these multiple systems, is something that we can and should do. We do it for plane crashes, and we do it in deaths that occur in a licensed healthcare facility. There is really no reason we should not do it in these cases where a person has contact with the criminal justice system and is mentally ill. What we learn may help us untangle the criminal justice system and the mental health system so we can take the burden of responsibility of those who have mental illness off our police, our courts, our corrections, officials, and the workers. And it may help us find a creative and cost-effective way to get appropriate and needed care to those struggling with mental illness. If you have any questions, perhaps I can answer them.
Any questions, members? Seeing none, Ms. McNellis, thank you for your testimony. Appreciate that. Ms. Engelking?
Good morning. My name is Brenda Engelking, and I'm from Central Minnesota Housing Partnership. According to the 2003 Wilder Survey, 58% of individuals in shelters or on the streets had just been discharged from a correctional facility. 66% of those leaving county jails did not have a stable place to live upon discharge. According to Stearns County Jail staff, at any time, at least 40 individuals would benefit from appropriate discharge planning, and a majority of these people have mental health issues. And we know that 55% of the people being discharged from Stearns County reoffend. And nationally, 88% of people incarcerated have a mental health issue. It is a privilege to be here today to talk about the need for successful discharge planning that would include support for mental health services. As the Central Continuum of Care Coordinator, I have conducted a gaps analysis in Central Minnesota, and the greatest two needs in the entire 14 county is to find housing for offenders and provide mental health services for these offenders. Currently, there is no funding or requirements for county jail staff to provide proper discharge planning. In 2005, I helped form the Community and Corrections Reentry Council. This council consisted of service providers, county jail and human services staff, faith-based organizations, housing developers, and advocates for housing and mental health issues. Our mission was simple: create a successful discharge model that would reduce homelessness and recidivism for people leaving jails in central Minnesota. Our hope was to replicate this model in all 14 counties. Here's why you need to care about discharge planning. Because financially it makes sense. Preventing homelessness is always cheaper than pulling someone out of homelessness. We must help break the cycle of homelessness and recidivism. The only way to do this is to provide individuals with the needed resources for them to become productive citizens, not a drain on society and our resources. We have done the hard work, we've identified the gaps and needs, and we've formed partnerships and created a screener discharge planner position for the Stearns County. Now, I just ask your support for House File 196, specifically the portion providing increased funding to jails for screener discharge planning for those with severe and persistent mental illness, traumatic brain injury, chemical dependency, and are at risk of becoming homeless. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and testify. I'm not sure if you are Mr. Taylor or Mr. Unwin.
Madam Chairman, my name is Joel Gibbons. I am the director of Central Minnesota Reentry Project, which is located up in Benton and Morrison and Stearns in Sherman County. I currently sit on the RAP program in Stearns County, which is the Release Advanced Planning project that the Stearns County has modeled after the program that Brenda has worked on. And we meet every week with individuals who are being released from the jail in Stearns County. And we are, the group is made up of individuals from human services from Stearns County, which include mental health, corrections, finance, and various other organizations within the county that provide services to the individuals. Upon meeting with the individuals, we find out exactly what are all of their needs prior to them being released. And majority of them that I've been experienced, because I've been doing this now in Stearns County for about a year and a half, finding out that the majority of them are have some type of mental illnesses and mental conditions. The nurses will work with them and find out what they need, so when they are released, that they make sure that they are getting the proper type of medicines, and also if they have to be assessed Rule 25, which will be assessed their mental illness if they need to go to treatment or they need to go to some type of facility. The majority of these people who are released come out of jail with no money, no housing, and they're just going to be on the street. Now, the county, which is the RAP program, can identify all the needs that they need as far as financial assistance, medical assistance, medicine that they need prior to the receiving, but when they get out, they walk out the door. And if they have no place to go, then it's basically that's where I step in. My program steps in to find them housing and other type of services that they need on the outside, because it's not the county's responsibility to do that at this point. So I have identified in the community the various housing that are available to these people. But the problem is when we put them in the various housing, that needs to be paid for. They have no money, so they don't have any down payment on the rent deposit or the first month payment. So it's a major problem. And I would think that by providing the assistance to the counties, it would help them to be able to have the funding. Now, granted, TRICAP was Tri-County Action Group, and also the counties have emergency assistance funding. But a majority of those are, you have to have a job prior to get the funding for your housing. Well, what comes first is chicken or the egg. So it's a real problem. It's a serious problem. And so we try to do is find the type of funding that we need. When I sit on this RAP committee each week, when these people are being released, if we know that we can provide them with that initial housing, with that 72 hours prior to your release, and if you don't get some type of stability, and if you're just on the street, the majority of them will reoffend. They don't know any difference. And listening to all the testimony about catching the mental illness of children at the ages of 4 and 5, and prior to that, if they slip through the cracks, they're tomorrow's inmates in most cases, because one third of the inmates in correctional facilities have mental illnesses. So if we get the money up front to work with the provider with the services they need when they're very young, we eliminate a lot of the problems. It costs $30,000 a year to incarcerate one person in the federal or in state penitentiaries. So it seems to me that if we would put the money up front and provide the treatment and for that, we won't have to worry about spending so much money incarcerating them and then working with them afterwards. So I'm just here to tell my story about that. Mm-hmm. If you have any questions, please.
Mr. Gibbons, there is. So Representative Haas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to Central Minnesota delegation coming here and testifying. It's good to have that. I just wanted to see if you could talk about the success of the discharge planning, if you have any statistics.
Well, the program was charged to just do that. They last year, we had asked the county if they could provide us some funds to help these people prior to them getting out with them. And so he came up with, over the last 5 years, I think that's 4 or 5 years since that program has been involved, and they did track that, and the percent was a success was very high. I don't have the exact figures, but I can get them for you.
Representative Haas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just want to talk about how successful a proactive approach can be on this. With the discharge planning, the county has seen the police contacts that occurred before the jailing and after the release have dropped by over 50% in Stearns County. And we had a representative from the county come before us, before the mental health caucus this week, and talked about the program and how successful it's been. And I don't have the numbers exactly myself, but I know it was over for the select group that was in the study, over 400 police contacts before they went into prison. I believe it went down to about 160 contacts after release. And that's a significant savings for our prison system, and it's taking a proactive approach.
I can tell you that in my program, which I started a year and a half ago, I retired in 1999 and needed something to do, so I've decided to start a prisoner entry program. But I've worked with over 50 inmates that come out of state penitentiaries. Of those 50, only three so far have reoffended that I've worked with. Now, that's incredible. Now, this is only a year and a half, so we still take a long time to really judge that and the criteria of how successful these programs are. But I know for a fact is that if we can get them and we can assign volunteers to them and provide them the services that they need, the housing and the support services, such as a good friend as a volunteer, as a mentor, we will keep them out of prison.
Thank you. Appreciate that. See no other questions. I thank you for testifying and coming down this morning.
Thank you.
Now, it's Mr. Taylor again. If you could identify yourself for the tape, sir.
Yes, thank you. My name is Terry Taylor. I'm a consumer. More precisely, I'm a paranoid schizophrenic. I'm here to talk about my experience in the discharge planning from what I call the system, which is the criminal justice system. The only planning expected from me was that I was required to come up with two plans as to where I was going to go when I was going to be discharged. I was going to be given my 3 days' worth of medication upon discharge with no insulin and no way of discharging the insulin into myself. I tried to pick a veteran's halfway house, which was denied because I was told that if I didn't come up with a suitable plan, I was going to be put in a motel, which they would take for 3 days, and then I was on my own, which means I had to provide them financial backing for either staying in a hotel or providing my own suitable lodging. I had 24 hours to find my PO and obtain my, it wasn't 24 hours to obtain, but I was required to obtain my ID, driver's license, except for job placement on my own. When things were at the worst, a friend of mine recommended me to the Salvation Army, which stepped in and provided me with a structured environment in which I was able to go to, and with being as I am a disabled vet, I was able to be allowed to go from the Salvation Army to the Veterans Administration to reobtain my medication. That's about all I have to say. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Taylor, for sharing your story. Are there any questions or comments from members? Seeing none, I really appreciate you coming down. It's not the easiest to do, having all these eyes look at you while you're sharing your personal information. So we can thank you.
Out of my mind.
You're not the only one. We all go through it. Trust me. Mr. Unling? Is that here? Okay. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members, interested parties. My name is Michael Unling. On June 9th, I learned what happens too easily when mental illness meets police in jail. On June 6th, Plymouth police took me into protective custody, drunk, and texting suicidal messages to my wife. When I tried to run, they took me down. They were professional and caring. They had a CAT scan run to be sure I was okay. June 9th was very different. A police officer approached me in the ER. He saw, without knowing it, a reasonably successful, educated 50-year-old, married 29 years, daughters in college, by anyone's account, stable. In December 2002, a moderate work stress shifted my brain over an edge I was unknowingly on. I felt it, unaware of what it meant. In a week, cognitive impairment, I couldn't focus, comprehend what I read, or write a paragraph. My brain felt disconnected. My therapist said I was too depressed to suicide. Help might give me the energy to do it. partial hospitalization, severe depression, and anxiety PTSD signs. I reached a very primitive instinct survival mode that sounds counterintuitive. No appetite, 35 pounds in 6 weeks. No sleep, once for 7 days. Hospitalization, emotional dysregulation, and overactive part of the brain. Meds plus daily therapy for a year. Since, variations on the theme. Disappearances, alcohol and overdose, hospitals, therapy, horrible family stress. With support. Back to June 9th. The officer sees a man on a gurney, curled, fetal position, eyes closed, still. From earlier, when a mental health nurse, instead of letting me talk to her supervisor or above about discharge being incomplete, called security to kick me out instead of setting up the CD treatment as all had agreed. Patient's rights, ignored. The stress crashed me. I was non-responsive on the couch, decompensating before her eyes. She had security lift me up and wheelchair me off the property. I was still non-responsive, so they brought me to the ER. The ER nurse was upset. What? This is nonsense. No one doesn't want to leave a mental unit. Psych eval? Readmit? Call his wife? No. Call the police? Yes. The officer dislikes non-responsiveness. He jams his knuckle below my ear to make me talk. No response? Harder. No response? If you don't leave, you'll be arrested for trespassing. Shock and fear instinctively kick adrenaline into my brain. Trespassing? Aren't you supposed to investigate before you arrest someone? Check my medical records. Go talk to people. My brain is spent that quickly. Back to safety, survival instinct, like a turtle pulled in. Sit him up, handcuffs, real tight, painful. I'm lifted to the floor. Disability, meds, mental health, no one asks, no one tells. Nothing in the police report or the 911 call. The CIT team never had a chance. No one asks if I might have reason or right to be there. I did. It's been dismissed. No one cares. Laws are selectively enforced. They literally drag me out, feet trailing behind. My wrists are killing me. Why'd he do that? They carry me to the jail intake floor. Police and jail discussion about disability or med issues? None. They pat me down. I was still non-responsive, so they got tougher. I puked. They ask medical and mental health questions. Non-responsiveness is deemed healthy, so I'm carried to a cell floor. Alone at last, it is dark, quiet, and safe. For an hour, but my wrists still hurt. The officer? On tape? Idiots. They're all idiots. When I open my eyes, I see wrists with deep purple grooves 360 degrees around. I ask to get pictures of what the cop did to my wrists. We don't do that here, sir. Multiple iterations of this back and forth over time. Law enforcement against law enforcement, they don't document. Not here. And I get a nurse? What for? To document my wrists. A nurse did come. We argued. She finally agreed to document, but she never did. 3 hours later, I asked for the nurse because she said she'd be back. We'll leave her a message. Later, she's busy. Too busy, sir. She might be coming. I don't know, sir. Look, she's busy with real emergencies. I made a minor abrasion on my arm, and the nurse was there in minutes. Sir, what in the hell are you doing? I scratched my arm so you would document my wrists. No one would get you. If you do anything like that again, you'll be in a restraint chair. Much arguing with nurse and guards to document wrists. They pretend they can't see. The nurse won't look, but wants to see the abrasion. Check my wrists first. The abrasion is nothing. You promised to document my wrists. Do you have any nurse ethics? She finally agrees they're still red, but against policy, orders a restraint chair due to the arguing. She says it was due to safety concerns. No one tried lesser means, per policy. Tape shows I calmly stated 12 times that I had no reason to hurt myself once she agreed to document. Against policy, she doesn't involve the doctor. The abrasion is so minor, it isn't treated. Her medical record said it was. You can see on tape that it wasn't. Either the lieutenant or sergeant in charge orders a deputy to not double lock my handcuffs until after the nurse checks them. A nice setup to crank handcuffs and wrist straps tight. After the safety check. For 1 hour, the pain is bad but bearable. My hands swell and go numb. The handcuffs squeeze tighter behind my back and the chair because you're pulled in tight. Or they were ratcheted tight to begin with. Agony either way. For over 3 hours, I cried. Begged for mercy. A nurse whimpered. On tape, guards laughing and mocking. I called on God, my wife. Most health checks lasted seconds or fractions of seconds. I hallucinated from the pain. Relax, you're not going to die, someone said. No one cared, or worse, they cared, it's what they wanted. After 4 hours, I was removed. Before removal, a nurse chimes in. You did this to yourself, sir. No, I didn't. I want pictures. This is a crime scene. How do I call the police? The nurse warns that if I don't be quiet and cooperate, they'll keep me in the chair. Fear shuts me up. To help me to stand, a guard happens to touch my wrist. I scream from the searing pain. How do I call the police? One brave, misguided deputy suggests the cop shop. No. He is shut down fast. Photograph my wrists. I want pictures of my wrists. If you don't cooperate, you are going back in the chair. Fear wins the argument. Again, they got what they wanted. Jail incident report? I was uncooperative and making unreasonable demands which could not be accommodated. You have the power to enact laws to stop this. But if laws have no teeth, no clear criminality, no enforceability, they won't protect those who follow too similar a path against unwarranted pain and suffering. Or worse, others have died. Like 21-year-old Timothy Sauter a few months ago. Mentally ill, minor crime, restrained to bed for long hours. They shut off his water. In 4 days, he died of dehydration. It was on 60 Minutes, somebody mentioned. Everyone asks if I have an attorney. I don't. It is secondary to things like this. Providing insight to help agencies... and lawmakers understand what is needed. I appreciate the bill that is under consideration. On the back, I've outlined some detailed suggestions for consideration based on my experience to shore up some things that I think might help. I won't go through all that detail here. I thank you very much for your time. For some people who may be interested in more detail or seeing video from the jail to make their own opinions up regarding what happened versus relying on mine. Of course, I'm not fully objective. You're welcome to the CD-ROMs. It's got a lot of information in there. And for some people, they want to look at the detail. I know some people are looking at it on the Senate side. Other than that, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Unlin. Is there any questions or comments by members? And thank you again on behalf of the committee for taking the time to come testify. Ms. Havitt.
Good morning, Madam Chair Walker and members of the committee. My name is Deborah Havitt. I'm a parent and I'm also part of the MACMA staff. In the year 1999, my 13-year-old son was going through bodily changes due to puberty. Looking back, one can remember Mike's obsessive compulsive tendencies when, as a bright, focused toddler and preschooler, he memorized the names of all 50 states every jet, different types of rocks, types of cloud formations, baseball players, birds, dinosaurs, and on and on. At age 11, he was a typical, friendly, busy pre-teenager, filling out, but not yet stretching up. Growth spurts take kids by surprise. Suddenly he went from being 5 feet tall to 5'9" at the end of seventh grade. Most of us think of a 5'9", 126-pound person as thin, but Mike thought he was fat. He began to loathe his body. He secretly decided not to eat. He was very deceptive about fooling people into thinking he was eating, stuffing food up his sleeves, asking friends to lie for him. He went from 126 pounds in the summer to 82 pounds 6 months later in December. He lost 2 inches in height, and twice he broke bones in his feet from walking. As soon as I suspected he had anorexia, I sought help for him. I had difficulty finding him adequate care. I lived in northern Minnesota at the time. Calls to Minnesota's two eating disorder programs proved futile. There were long waiting lists that kept patients waiting for many, many months before they could get admitted. Mike didn't have months. He was so thin and refusing to eat that he would have died if we waited months. The family medical clinic in Detroit Lakes was the best care we could find. The psychologist was a fine man, but he did admit that he had never treated an anorexic. The MD and psychologist only weighed Mike with his clothes on, layers of jeans, sweatshirts, and coats. Mike was always so cold, even when everybody else around him was hot. The scale actually showed Mike was gaining weight under the new care, but Mike's appearance and behavior told a different story. We discovered that Mike had fooled the doctors by taping rolls of quarters to his body, adding more with each appointment to give the illusion of weight gain. The trick is common with anorexics. Girls will stuff weight into their bras. But untrained health providers are not aware of the measures to which an anorexic will take to avoid weight gain. Mike was also exercising whenever possible. Finally, months later, he became so frightened that he admitted it was out of control. He said he was up to 5,500 sit-ups a day, and his mind kept telling him he had to beat his record every day. His bony back was raw. He looked exactly like a concentration camp victim, but he still thought he was fat. The psychologist had felt that medication was unnecessary. He believed in psychoanalysis. Finally, after 5 months of going to clinic appointments in Detroit Lakes, I finally persuaded the psychologist to make an emergency referral call to Fargo to an outpatient adolescent psychiatric clinic for eating disorders under the care of psychiatrist Dr. James Mitchell. After months of outpatient care, because they didn't have adolescent inpatient there, Dr. Mitchell became convinced that Mike needed inpatient psychiatric care for anorexia. Still, there wasn't any program we could get Mike into in Minnesota. Our insurance company had a practice of denying care. Only constant letter writing by our doctors and our family to the insurance company and to Senator Wellstone had an effect. Finally, on January 4th, 2001, Mike and I got in a car in a blizzard and drove to the University of Iowa Hospital and Clinic. And there he stayed for 5 months of inpatient and partial hospital care and several years of outpatient care. I resigned my job as a teacher in northern Minnesota to go to Iowa. I chose to stay there because my son was thriving under the excellent care of the University of Iowa Hospital and Clinics. My parents and I spent thousands of dollars to get Mike the care he needed. It took $17,000 just for the down payment to get him in the door on the first day. And then it was an additional $1,000 a day for the 5 months. Mike's anorexia was not simply a matter of choice. A lot of people think, oh, they love control. It's a choice. No, it was caused by a severe chemical imbalance in his developing brain. And the more weight they lose, the more that imbalance becomes. for seven years later now, he still struggles some with depression and obsessive compulsive disorder. Now he thinks he has to get A pluses in college, and it's sad. He thinks it's sad if he gets an A. He cannot go back to his excellent outpatient team because his university health care won't cover the cost. He went to his counselor that he had had, and she said, no, we can't cover you because your student health won't cover it. And that same university hospital. Antidepressant medications can save lives, but even after insurance, a month's supply can cost up to $200. And Mike's anorexia required a very high dose of Prozac to decrease the obsessive-compulsive exercising and starvation impulse. Without proper medication, his anorexia can return. As many as 10 million females and 1 million males in the United States are suffering from eating disorders. Anorexia is a very deadly mental illness. It requires immediate intensive care. Please pass comprehensive medical health bills that will help save people's lives from these devastating disorders. Minnesota needs to increase the number of psychiatrists and other professionals that are trained in recognizing and treating children's mental health disorders, such as eating disorders. We need adequate coverage for all college students so they can continue receiving services from their mental health teams. And access to inpatient hospitalization is essential. Time is of the essence when somebody has anorexia. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Cavett, for sharing, and I'm glad to hear that Mike is doing well. Struggling, but doing well. Is there any questions or comments from members? Thank you again.
And we have Ms. Gildow.
Gildow.
G-I-L-O-W. Misspelling there. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Judy Gilo, and I'm from Winona, Minnesota, and I am the parent of a 39-year-old adult son with a mental illness. I'd like to pass this picture around, if that's okay, Madam Chair, just to put a face to our son, Bob. We also lost a son, Kevin, and he's also in the picture, to suicide almost 3 years ago, who, by the way, had an appointment with the mental health center June 8th, but killed himself on May 26th. Our son Bob was hyperactive as a child and put on Ritalin about fourth or fifth grade. As he got older, he got in with the wrong crowd and ended up in the juvenile justice system. I talked with teachers, social services, and others saying there was something wrong, but was told he just had a behavioral problem. Now remember, he's now 39, so this is several years ago. And he was labeled a bad kid. In high school, he was put into in-school suspension, which is what they did then. When he turned 16, one of his teachers asked him if he was going to quit school now that he was 16 or stay around and aggravate us. What do you suppose he did? He quit. After he turned 18 and got into trouble, I talked to the county attorney, again asking for help. And what I told him, he took him to court and used against Bob to prosecute him, and the judge sent him to prison. He has been in and out of prison all of his adult life. I think this is several years ago, I think we finally got social services to do a mental health assessment after he got my husband, his dad, down on the sidewalk in town and was going to beat on him. I went to social services. They wanted us to turn in a complaint on Bob to have him prosecuted again. We both said no way. That was not the answer. Every time he came out of prison, he was worse. He was finally diagnosed with schizophrenia. But as with most people with a mental illness, he goes off his meds when he feels better, doesn't feel he needs them. So we go into another round of him getting into trouble, going to prison, and coming out not on his meds. And it's my understanding that when they're in jail or prison, they do not have to take their meds. So most of them choose not to. The last time he got out of prison, which is almost 2 years now, he was discharged and stayed in a motel room for a couple of months, then said he couldn't afford that and lived homeless in the woods by Lake Winona. We After several attempts to have him put on a 72-hour hold, a great policeman in Winona saw Bob sitting by a bridge in the pouring rain. He radioed to dispatch and said, this may be against protocol, but I cannot stand to see this man out here any longer, and took him to the ER. And that was an experience, as we've already heard testimony for. Thank God for the policeman. I went down to ER and took a picture of Bob, which is the picture you just saw, with me, and that shows when Bob is good and on his meds. And I asked the ER doctor, does this look like the man sitting in front of you? And of course it didn't. His feet actually had trench foot from being wet all the time, not taking his shoes off. Years before, he froze his feet from walking in the snow all night. Our family doc told him then that if he froze them one more time, he would probably lose them. He told me yesterday, that the foot doctor told him he needs foot care to the tune of about $1,000, but Medicare or medical assistance will not pay for it. A few months ago, he got into trouble. My daughter, who is a paralegal, found in the statute book a 2003 law that addresses certain mental illness to keep the person out of prison on an alternative sentencing. And I have that here if Madam Chair would like that piece, and Mindy is familiar with it. 90 days in a halfway house, the rest of the time in a three-quarter way house. There's not a house out there for this kind of person. A halfway house is it doesn't have to be that restrictive as a halfway house is, but a three-quarter way house is too lenient. They don't have enough supervision. To me, this is setting him up for failure. And when he was in court, the judge made it very clear to him that if he violates, he will go directly to prison. Is this the answer? I don't think so. I have 2 points here. One is of the early screening and teen screening. Had this been available, Bob and our entire family could have been spared a lot of heartache and the taxpayers a lot of dollars that are involved when sending someone to jail and prison. Number two is we need more housing for the mentally ill. There is such a shortage. Courts are trying to create an alternative, but we need the housing. Also, the good discharge planning, as we've already heard, and follow-up would be a help also. As a past county commissioner in Winona County, I used to say sometimes we have to double fund things to realize a savings in the end. To get the savings in the jails and prisons, we need to fund more supervised housing so that they don't reoffend. Again, there goes your double funding, because you're not going to realize it right away. I could go on and on. This is a very short version of a very, very long story. And I thank you for giving me the opportunity to share part of it with you. Also, as a gentleman just before testified, our son went through some of the same abuse when he was taken into custody as that gentleman had. But, of course, there's not time to testify to all that. Thank you. If there's any questions that you have.
Thank you, Ms. Little. Are there any questions by members? Again, I want to thank you for coming down this morning. Ms. Ephraim, you want to come on up? And we only have a few moments, and hopefully we can get through. Otherwise, we'll have to continue the testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. My name is Dr. Karen Ephraim. I am a mother of three children, a pediatrician, and a policy analyst for EdWatch, as well as the Alliance for Human Research Protection and two other national organizations. While I want to express my great respect and empathy for Representative Greiling and for what she is dealing with and what for many other people are dealing with in relation to mental health issues, I also want to urge extreme caution regarding the provisions in this bill on mental health screening. Particularly the teen screen grants, the MFIT screening program, and the provision on line 1018 for quote-unquote at-risk children, however that's defined. The concerns that we have are, number one, lack of science and medical consensus within the expert community about the diagnostic criteria themselves, much less the criteria for what's considered at risk and for the questions on the screening instruments. The Surgeon General's report that is often used to give the statistics that 10% of children have a mental illness also said, quote, the diagnosis of mental disorders is often believed to be more difficult than the diagnosis of somatic or general medical disorders, since there is no definitive lesion, laboratory test, or abnormality in the brain tissue that can identify the illness. The authors of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is the main manual for psychiatric diagnosis, said, quote, the DSM-4 criteria remain a consensus without clear empirical data supporting the number of items required for the diagnosis. Furthermore, the behavioral characteristics specified in DSM-4, despite efforts to standardize them, remain subjective. The experts also acknowledge that the younger the child is, the more difficult it is to accurately diagnose them. Dr. Benedetto Vitiello, who is chairman of child and adolescent psychiatry at the National Institutes of Mental Health, said in a journal article in Pediatrics, quote, he acknowledged the, quote, diagnostic uncertainty surrounding most manifestations of psychopathology in early childhood, end quote. The Surgeon General and the World Health Organization have made similar statements. Next, I want to talk about the high false positive rates with these screening instruments. Dr. David Schaefer, the author of Teen Screen and head of psychiatry at Columbia University, admitted in his own research paper on Teen Screen that the survey, quote, would result in 84 non-suicidal teens being referred for treatment for every 16 suicidal youths correctly identified. The false positive rate for ages and stages, which is the common young child screening instrument used in Minnesota, is 73%. Now, if or 84 out of 100 people were falsely told that they had diabetes or, heaven forbid, cancer, how long do you think that type of screening instrument or test would stay around? And to put a face on that, I want to tell you about Chelsea Rhodes, a high school girl who went to school in northern Indiana with no psychiatric concerns, who took the teen screen test, was given the teen screen test without her parents' knowledge or consent, and was told, because she answered positively to wanting to keep her room clean and because she didn't like to attend parties so that she could maintain her grades, that she had two psychiatric disorders, social anxiety disorder and obsessive compulsive disorder. So that's certainly the kind of issue that is a concern. And in fact, San Francisco Unified Schools and other school districts across the country have rejected Teen Screen because of that very concern of the high false positive rate. The lack of effectiveness of screening is also another concern. The United States Preventive Services Task Force said, quote, found no evidence that screening for suicide risk reduces suicide attempts or mortality. There is limited evidence on the accuracy of screening tools to identify suicide risk in the primary care setting, including tools to identify those at high risk, end quote. The chairman of that task force said in an interview a year later that they would have the same findings as before, and in addition, quote, screening inevitably leads to treating some people who do not need it. Such interventions have consequences beyond side effects from drugs or other treatments. Just ask Chelsea. I actually calculated, based on that 84% false positive rate and the fact that 60%, according to the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatrists, of depressed kids receive antidepressants. That would be somewhere, depending on how you do the calculations, between 3,000 and 5,000 children that were unnecessarily exposed to antidepressants just from one screening program.
Ms. Buford, sorry to cut you off, because we still have to move Representative Grilling's amendment before we adjourn. Are you almost near being done?
I would like to come back if that is within the purview of the chair, because there are several other points, mainly about consent for screening and treatment and over-identification of poor and minorities and overlooking that I would like to present to the committee if that's possible.
Ms. Ephraim, we'll talk right after the committee is adjourned. Members, just for your information, we didn't know. I had our CA check with Ms. Ephraim about 10 minutes, knowing the time was getting away from us, and thought that she could be finished in 5 minutes. And that was not the case, and so we don't want to keep members here any longer without getting to Representative Grilling's amendment. And so if you could just stop here, we'll move Representative Grilling's amendment, and then we'll talk after the committee, if that's okay. Representative Grilling, we need to get your bill back off the table for a moment.
All right.
If you could move that.
I move that the House Bill 196 be taken off the table so that it can be amended.
Those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, Representative Grilling, we have this amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Amendment A7. And do you want me to explain it briefly?
If you could do that, please.
We're deleting Section 1 and replacing it with Section 6 down below there, Disciplinary Confinement and Protocol. In a moment, I have a couple of oral amendments for that. And then on page 6, line 30, these county jail reentry projects, we're adding in there, at a minimum, one project at least must be located outside the 7-county metro area. And then the final section is adding in incentive payments that we added in last time for extended employment basic for the 3 employment support special projects that are in another part of the bill for mental health courts, people coming out of civil commitment and such. The oral amendments are the first, there's two. One is on line 1.8 and strike earn their way out of and replace it with be released from. And then on line 1.9, insert after confinement in a timely manner. So now that line is saying that inmates have an opportunity to be released from disciplinary confinement in a timely manner. Then I have one more on 1.10, after shall and before develop, insert when possible. These are requests, Madam Chair, members, from the Department of Corrections so that they can support this amendment, and I have checked its passed to Abner Holden, the current chair of the network. So I would urge support of these changes.
Members, we're going to just adopt the oral changes by author's request for the amendment. Are there any questions or comments or concerns about the amendment? Seeing none, Representative Grilling. Mm-hmm. Move to have A7 amended into House File 196. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. A7 has been amended, or House File 196 has been amended, and we are going to lay House File 196 back on the table, and the meeting is adjourned.